Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I'm your host, Massimo Pigliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Gilliff. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Massimo, today our topic is essentially the law of unintended consequences and how it thwarts even the most meticulous and devoted efforts to make ethical choices about, say, what to do or what to buy in terms of being responsible environmentally and socially. And, how our very best efforts in those regards can end up backfiring or just not helping as much as we thought they were.
Yeah, so this is particularly relevant to me because of sort of recent personal experience. You know, I've always tried to some degree and at some level to make reasonable choices in my eating habits, in my buying habits, and all that. But more recently, I've become sort of more aware of the consequences, more sensitive, I guess, to ethical consequences of what I do in general. And therefore, I developed sort of this heightened sense of, okay, well, should I really buy this or buy it or eat that, and so on and so forth. Now, it seemed to me that all I needed to do was to document myself about, you know, the basic of productions of certain goods and productions of foods. But I'm not talking just about food and dietary choices. I'm also talking about, you know, do you buy made in the U.S. or do you avoid made in China? What is it? You know, what sort of consequences and priorities do you have when it comes to your consumer habits? And so I thought initially, as it turns out, very naively, that, well, you know, I'm going to spend some time reading about sort of the lay of the land, the ethical landscape of the, and, you know, for the ethical consumer, and then I'll make my priority and I'll stick with them. And, well, the problem is that, as you were saying a minute ago, there are unintended consequences to almost everything that we do. Mm-hmm. And which is beginning to let me realize that, in fact, ethical decision making really has to be something that you need to treat almost as a Bayesian, in a Bayesian way. That is, you got certain priors, and you make decisions on your best guess at the moment, but you need to be able to readjust your guesses and you readjust your priorities constantly as new information comes in, which means that you need to be much more active and also flexible in the way you prioritize things. Now, all of this sounds very esoteric, so let me give you an example.
Yes, please.
So one of the things that I started eating recently is a very nice, very healthy and very protein-rich and tasty grain called quinoa.
Quinoa?
Quinoa. Now, the problem is, and it's become very popular in sort of among vegetarians or among people who try to reduce at least eat meat consumption and all that sort of stuff, because it does have a lot of positive characteristics from the point of view of sort of dietary perspective.
High protein, low calorie.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and particularly for vegans, I'm not a vegan, but particularly for vegans, this has become a major staple, essentially. And the problem is that, of course, the quinoa is originary of the Andes region, so it's South America. And it's in fact referred to as the miracle grain of the Andes. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem, of course, is that once the rest of the world, particularly the Western affluent world, started going after quinoa, the price went up. Obviously, it's a simple question of market. In fact, it went so far up that it tripled since 2006. Now, what that has meant is not just that, you know, you and I have to pay more for access to the quinoa, which is fine. Mm-hmm. You know, that's part of the idea that if you make ethical decisions, yeah, they're going to carry a cost, in this particular case, a monetary cost, and you're willing to shell out the money if you can afford it. The problem is another one. It's that the local populations in Peru and Bolivia, for instance, for which quinoa was a major staple, now they cannot afford it anymore because this price has gone significantly up. And so they find themselves now eating junk food, imported junk food, because imported junk food has become cheaper locally than the quinoa itself. Clearly, that is not a good consequence of what I intended to do by choosing that particular, making that particular choice.
So I did see that article, and I had, like I assume you, a pang of like, oh man, should I reevaluate my quinoa eating choices? And then I saw another article, I think in Slate, a day or two later, which said that, it's a good thing for quinoa farmers in Bolivia or Peru that the price of quinoa has gone up so much. It's making their lives much better. It's worse, of course, for the poor people in, say, urban areas who were relying on quinoa to consume, but they don't produce it. So they're worse off. But at the same time, you have a lot of them moving back to the countryside now that quinoa farming is so profitable. Uh-huh. So there's more of an equilibrium being achieved there. Right. And, it's just yet another step in the chain of, yes, but on the other hand...
Exactly. And that actually makes my point.
So unclear. Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Because the point of this whole story was not that quinoa is bad. It's that it's so hard to tell.
Not at all. Exactly. That it's not quite as straightforward as, oh, here it is. It's a good idea. Let's do it. Because as soon as, in fact, that part of the reason it's not such a straightforward, there's no straightforward answer anymore, is because so many people have chosen, made that decision to switch diet in that direction. Because initially, it was a completely unquestionable good idea. But the more time passes, the more people make that sort of that kind of choice, the more there are unintended consequences. And as you just pointed out, even the unintended consequences are not that straightforward. There's the reasonable argument one way or the other. This is a negative consequence, but this other one is a positive one. Which one should be way more? Now, the same article that I started with also points out that there are other problems in terms of unforeseen consequences with all sorts of other stuff. For instance, do you like asparagus? Because I do.
Yes, I do.
Well, and it turns out asparagus is grown in Peru, and in particularly arid regions
Ica region.
Yeah. arid regions of Peru. And the problem with that, of course, is that this is a very thirsty crop. And so this has led to shortage of water resources for the local populations.
Right.
Again, this is something that is very healthy for you and me. And it's a very good choice in terms of, what to put on our plates. But it's creating some level of problems, locally for the people who actually produce them. And of course, even though what you said earlier in terms of the quinoa is true, that the local populations that do produce them are actually better off in terms of making more money, it's also true that let's not kid ourselves, the majority of the profits of these things goes to international corporations and supermarkets, not to the local producers necessarily. So the life of the local producers gets better, but it's not that they necessarily get a fair share. That depends on what the various agreements with the international corporations and the production lines of these things are. Another one is the soya. Soya is incredibly popular among vegetarians and vegans and so on and so on and so forth, mm-hmm. for the same reason. Now, here's a little problem that has emerged in the meantime, and that is that it's become so popular that now soya production is one of the two main causes of deforestation in South America.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, of course, being cattle ranching. So, okay, you stop eating, McDonald's burger, in part at least, because you don't want, to increase deforestation in South America. It turns out that the alternative you pick is, in fact, having essentially the same result. All of this is not to say... Right, yeah, that's right. Still, at least soya is not an animal, it's not suffering. That's right. So it may still be the ethical choice. I'm pretty sure it still is. But again, it's one of those examples that have started accumulating in my mind recently of, oh, crap, this thing is much more complicated than I thought. And it requires sort of constant updating. It requires being aware of, these problems, the counter responses, how people may change their behavior to ameliorate these problems. It really gets complicated. So it's not very easy to be, in fact, an ethically, intelligently ethically informed consumer. You can be making ethical, what you think are ethical choices, and very simple ones, but they might turn out not to be quite as ethical and quite as simple as you thought.
Right. Yeah, this is one of the big problems with consequentialism, right? Or with utilitarianism is actually trying to calculate sometimes not even just the magnitude of the good you're doing, you know, and comparing it to other magnitudes of good, but sometimes the direction. Is it even positive? Is your action even net positive? There's, I wish I could remember now how this, what the name of the story was. Maybe it's just an old folktale about a man to whom something good happens, and everyone's like, well, isn't that great? Why aren't you rejoicing? And he says, well, we'll see. And then turns out that good thing had unintended bad consequences. Yeah. And they're like, why aren't you miserable and lamenting? And he says, well, we'll see how things turn out. And then that bad thing has unintended good consequences. Yep. And so on.
I think that's a classic story. Yeah, we have to track down the origin of it. But yes, that's very likely. Now, and this is not just about food. So let me give you another example that happened to me recently. So one of the things that I did was to change my credit card company to something called Working Assets. And Working Assets is a company that I've known for a long time, and it works with an interesting system. Basically, whenever you purchase something, a percentage of what you spend goes to a number of environmental or political causes. And, you know, this organization tends to be on the liberal progressive side of the spectrum. Not only that, but in fact, as a member of Working Assets, every year you get to vote on the organizations to which they give money. So it sounded like, okay, instead of giving money to a major, you know, corporate bank, why not, especially after what major corporate banks have done to the worldwide economy a few years ago, and why not doing this kind of thing? Well, I still think it's a good idea, but as it turns out, Working Assets, of course, does not have actually access to the same kind of circuits and availability of resources of big banks. So what do they have to do? They actually rely themselves on a big bank, in this particular case, Bank of America. And so now it becomes
one of the worst.
Yes, it's one of the worst. Exactly. So now you're talking, and they disclose that. It's not a surprise that they spring on you in the last minute. I mean, you know that. But the thing is, even though Working Assets as a company over time has in fact changed their providers, they do have their own internal systems of ranking, and occasionally they do switch. But switching from one provider to another, an entire network, is costly, and it's a difficult operation. So they only do it under extreme circumstances. So what that means is that what sounded initially as a slam dunk of, obviously good idea, turns out that, well, now I have to start thinking in my mind, well, how much of my money is actually going to these causes? How much is going in the direction that actually was the one that I wanted to avoid to begin with? And wouldn't be perhaps my money better spent if I just went to a local bank, let's say a credit union, and then gave money for charity directly instead of going through something like Working Assets, right? And I'm not saying that the calculus is easy, but it's the kind of thing that you have to sort of think about because you do make choices. And some of these choices, by the way, come with at a price because some of the ethical choices are either less convenient or more costly for the consumer, sure. Right? Which, is again, it's fine.
Or less tasty if you like your burgers.
Or less tasty. That's right, less tasty if you like your burger. That is fine, but then it's fine only if, in fact, the consequences, the intended result, is the correct one. If it's not even that clear that you're obtaining good results, then it may not be worth your sacrifice. So it gets complicated.
I thought about that with regard to socially responsible investing.
Yes,
people who invest with funds that pledge to only buy stocks of companies that are socially responsible and don't contribute to human rights abuse or environmental degradation or things like that.
Yep.
And I was just talking to a friend of mine who's in the finance world about this, and he was confirming my sense that it's not clear that you're actually doing any good by only investing in companies like that because, well, I mean, the company themselves doesn't get your money when you buy their stocks. Someone else who owned those shares gets your money.
Right.
And so if anything, you might be having a very slight impact on the price of the shares, but it's not clear at all whether that's good or bad for the company. You can see some good effects, but you can also see some bad effects. Even then it's like a very, very tiny effect if it is one at all, unless you're buying a ton of shares.
Right.
But it is a pretty popular way for people to act on their green impulses, right?
Absolutely. In fact, it turns out that Bloomberg and Reuters do provide environmental, social, and governance ratings of a number of companies. you know, that are on the stock market. So this information, the kind of information is actually out there. And in fact, as you might imagine, there's an app for that. There's more than one app for that. There's one actually, one that I use on a regular basis called Goodbye, as in two words, not goodbye as in bye-bye, but goodbye. And
I was like, was it something I said? Are we done already?
No, it's talking about you. But so Goodbye, which is actually produced in Australia, it's not an American company that produces the app. But the app basically sort of puts together a bunch of information on major brands. In this case, we're not talking about investment companies, actually. We're talking about companies that make all sorts of commercial products, from jeans to automobiles or whatever it is. And these companies are ranked according to a certain number of criteria in terms of environmental impact, in terms of sort of corporate responsibility, how they treat their workers, and that sort of stuff. And then there is an index, and you can basically decide, when you're about to, let's say, buy, I bought some jeans recently, and I went and checked the top two or three companies, and I got they were rated by Goodbye. And it turns out that one of those was the company that I'd usually buy my jeans from. So I was fine. But the thing is,
this is all a story about how virtuous you are, Massimo.
That's right. But so the point again is that, the information is out there. But first of all, of course, there's an issue of reliability of the information itself, right? I mean, how do I know that the Goodbye makers of the app actually are getting, reliable information? Well, I suppose at some point you have to trust some people. So there is that. Now, there are multiple sources for doing these things. So, for instance, there is Ethical Consumer Magazine and their website, which are put out by the Ethical Consumer Research Association. And, these are big organizations, and presumably, you can assume that they're actually doing their job. But even so, first of all, you have to look up the information, and it becomes complicated. It becomes, a sort of a problem in multivariate statistical analysis, because there's a lot of different, components of this thing. For instance, is it more important to you personally whether a company is environmentally conscious or is it socially conscious, as in, how they treat their workers? Because the two don't necessarily go together.
Sometimes those things can be at
odds, right? Correct. For instance, let's take one of my favorite companies, Apple Computers. I have the Holy Trinity usually in my backpack, which is my iPhone, my iPad, and my MacBook Air. Now, I'm very happy with those products as products, but Apple, on the one hand, has a very good record in terms of sort of environmental impact. They do have recycling programs. They do use green components and a bunch of these things. But in terms of sort of social aspects, in terms of the workers, almost all of their production line is in China. The workers' conditions there are not certainly far from ideal. There's been issues that have been well publicized in terms of safety on the work. And in fact, to their credit, Apple has been taking steps in a couple of different directions. On the one hand, they're be more vigilant about their line of production coming from China, and more recently they've actually announced that they will start producing some of their components in the United States. But it's complicated again, and at some point you have to make a decision. Besides, it's not like Apple's competitors are necessarily going to do any better. One of them may be doing better in a social aspect, but not necessarily in the environmental aspect. So, again, the message of this episode, I think, is going to be it's complicated.
So that the example of Apple is an example of a company, or it's an example of social responsibility and environmental responsibility not being necessarily one and the same, and it being possible for a company to be optimizing in one area but not the other. But the really hairy situations that I've come across are the ones where they're actually at odds. Like having more of one gives you less of the other.
Yeah.
Like let's say buying. Well, there's a whole other kettle of fish regarding this issue, but let's say that buying locally was actually good for the environment.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of debate there, but let's say it was good for the environment. By not buying goods from foreign countries, you are depriving the poor farmers, for example, right, in those countries of income that they otherwise would have had. So you're inhibiting economic development of very poor, suffering people in other countries in order to prioritize, not you know, increasing your carbon footprint.
Correct. And in fact, the same exact issue is with the whether to buy or not to buy, let's say, things that are not made in your own country, right? So I actually do tend to prefer buying goods that are made in the United States simply because, because I live in this country and I feel a heightened moral responsibility. You know, as you know, I'm not a utilitarian. I'm a virtual ethicist.
I know.
So I feel a heightened moral responsibility toward people that live in my society and they're close to me.
Does that really go along with being a virtue ethicist? That doesn't seem necessarily linked to me.
Well, it's a similar issue where, for instance, a virtue ethicist but not a utilitarian would say that you have a heightened moral responsibility toward your friends and family. From a utilitarian right? So from a utilitarian perspective, they don't matter any more than anybody else. There's no justification for you to be helping your daughter, let's say, or your son more than anybody else. It becomes a type of favoritism. But from
So you're just extending that to people you don't know who live in your same country.
Correct. We can have a discussion about, you know, whether that is a really good idea or not. But the point is,
we cannot have that discussion.
But the point is that once you make that choice, one way or the other, you're automatically going to penalize somebody else. Right. And, you know, somebody else is going to be worse off no matter what. And there are unintended consequences for that too, because, you know, I hear often, for instance, the refrain from some of my own friends say, well, you know, you should really, if anything, you should be buying more in China because, or in Bangladesh, let's say, because the conditions there are, you know, there's a lower level of standards than anywhere in the United States. And so other things considered, you're actually helping, reducing suffering worldwide better that way. First of all, that's a utilitarian argument, obviously. So if you don't buy utilitarian arguments, that's already questionable. But even if you do buy utilitarian argument, it's not entirely clear to me that that is actually the case. Because there are other consequences of, let's say, poverty that depend on the background conditions. For instance, in China, there is a much lower level of criminality than in the United States, and there is a much less of a link between poverty and criminality, just because the society works differently. Not only that, but in certain countries, you know, poor countries, there is access to education that is independent, essentially, or largely independent of personal income and wealth. That is not the case in the United States. So if you penalize a worker or a family in the United States on the ground that, well, you know, they're not quite as bad off as people in, say, China, well, in terms of actual amount of money that they bring home, that may very well be true. But because the safety net and the cultural environment is so different between the two countries, I'm not sure that one can actually make a direct comparison of that.
Wait, you think
the
safety net is better in China than in the U.S.?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Interesting.
And so, you know, again, it's, well, safety net, there too we could have a discussion about how you define a safety net. But a safety net in the United States is actually pretty awful, certainly by European standards. So if you don't like the comparison with China, we can make the same comparison. You know, should I buy United States, you know, made in America, or should I buy made in, you know, Spain or Italy or whatever it is? Well,
I don't really have a strong opinions about America versus Spain as I do about America versus
China.
Poor, developing country. But I think it also becomes tricky when the poorer countries use sources of fuel that are higher pollutant. Mm-hmm. Like China uses coal because it's cheaper, but it's also much worse for the environment.
That's right.
And so you might want to help countries like China develop and also buy things that are cheaper. But at the same time, that's worse from the environment.
The statistic. The statistic there is interesting. Just the other day, in the New York Times, there was this essentially is a really frightening environmental piece of data, which is that China now actually uses as much coal, and therefore it pumps it as much pollution into the atmosphere as the entire rest of the world combined. So, yes, they've been doing better, but the environment is not necessarily better off. In fact, it's significantly worse off.
Wow. Yeah, I thought that still the developed countries were you know, the disproportionate polluters. They didn't realize that China had caught up so much.
Well, it's a matter of numbers, obviously. It's, you know, there's a lot of them. And so it's, and it's been growing very fast. You know, the economy has been growing very fast, although less fast recently in recent years than it used to, but still.
I mentioned local food earlier, and I thought maybe I should expand on why that's also a complicated issue, just like all the issues we've been describing here.
Yeah, because most people think that that's another no-brainer, but it's not, as it turns out.
It really isn't. And so, I mean, I guess the reason that people think that it's a better choice ethically is that there's a smaller carbon footprint involved in just buying food that was grown nearby rather than shipped from foreign countries. But at the same time, even though local food might travel a shorter distance, it's still much less efficiently produced because, I mean, for a variety of reasons, large centralized farming operations can take advantage of economies of scale, which many distributed small farms can't. But also, different regions have different comparative advantages in what is easier for them to produce, depending on their temperature and their soil and their rainfall and so on. So if you, you know, if you don't specialize your production of food in terms of which region is best at producing it, then overall you just have a lower average efficiency of production of that type of food.
That's right.
Which means it requires more inputs and therefore more carbon footprint to produce the same yield of food.
Yeah. Which brings me, incidentally, now that you mentioned locally produced food, to books like The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan and others. So, you know, it sounds very good. I actually read some of those books, and they're interesting. They make for, you know, they make you think about food production and food consumption and all that. But again, there too, the situation is more complicated than it might seem. So some of the critics, for instance, of Michael Pollan's approach, I pointed out that it is, even if we all wanted to, it is simply unsustainable to go for local production, because in a lot of areas of the world, there just isn't enough local production to sustain the local population. It's just not going to work because, you know, the land use has evolved, of course, over a period of time. And so there are certain, you know, large areas of the world where there's simply not enough agricultural production, local agricultural production, to actually, you know, allow the majority of the population or the totality of the population to switch to the kind of diet, you know, locally produced foods that are so popular among environmentalists. I mean, it's the thing is, we have to realize that at least at the moment, and certainly for the foreseeable future, eating, you know, healthy and eating environmentally friendly and eating local and socially responsible and all that, it's a luxury. It isn't something that can be scaled up to the level of, you know, billions of people on the planet. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. I've also heard the same thing about organic farming.
Yes.
That if you're not allowing yourself to use the full range of available pesticides and herbicides and so on, then you end up needing to farm more land just in terms of area to yield the same amount of crops because you're producing less per unit, per acre or whatever.
Which brings us to another issue that maybe I thought we might not be able to actually touch on, but as it turns out, you just gave me the opening for that.
You're welcome. So unintentionally well-coordinated.
It is so unintentionally well-coordinated. Yes, I like that. And that is, let's say, you know, you just talked about food production and the fact that crops in a certain area may not be suitable, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what about GM crops? So genetically modified.
What about what? Oh, GMOs.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
So genetically modified crops actually would be able to help or could help in that area, because you can, through genetic modification, through genetic engineering, modify local crop production so that it does come closer to actually satisfy, you know, the issues of the you know, the needs of the local population. But of course, a lot of environmentalists are dead set against the use of GM, you know, genetically modified crops, even though, as it turns out, the empirical evidence is not even mixed at this point. You know, genetically modified foods have been in by a large number of people worldwide, and there are no reports of, you know, widely spread, you know, large scale or in fact even small scale either environmental or health problems. Now, that doesn't mean that there are no problems at all with GM production. For one thing, these things are produced by companies who, of course, make money in a certain way, and there are issues of, you know, exploiting the local food producer and so on and so forth. But there definitely isn't any scientific evidence, and now people have been looking for a long time, of either a deleterious environmental impact or a deleterious health impact of genetically modified organisms. And therefore, it sort of a knee-jerk reaction, sort of rejection on the part of environmentalists and progressive and liberals and all that, of those of that particular approach to food production, seems to me essentially a form of pseudoscience.
Did you happen to see the public apology and position reversal of one of the biggest anti-GMO advocates a couple weeks ago?
Yes.
Mark Linus,
I think. And that was, kudos to him.
In my bag of examples of people admitting they were wrong.
That's right. And it's, it takes quite a bit of guts actually to do that sort of thing. Now, generally speaking, I do agree, however, with something that was written by John McMurtry in The Global Markets as an Ethical System. That is, that the idea that there's simply no such thing as purchasing things without having without that purchase implying moral choices. That is, we always vote, so to speak, with our dollars. You know, anytime you spend money in doing something, you will have an impact on down the line, either directly or indirectly. On a bunch of things, anything that deals from, again, from social issues to environmental issues. So that means to me that as much as it is complicated, as we've been saying now for a while, and as much as it requires constant updating and willingness to revise your own positions about what constitutes an ethical purchase, that's not a counsel for despair, because it's not like you say, well, then I give up because I can't do anything. Even that is a decision that has ethical consequences anyway, because anything you do in the terms of purchasing things, goods, does have ethical consequences. So there's no way out.
No, but I think that's sort of the point of the people who throw up their hands is, if I can't be confident that I'm going to have a good ethical impact by spending the time working on it, then I might as well just not spend the time working on it, because I have no good reason to believe that the outcome will be better if I do spend the time thinking about it and making sacrifices versus if I don't.
Yes, you're right. If the situation were really that awful, that is, if your choices were essentially random in terms of consequences, I don't believe that they are.
Right. So that is sort of one of my concerns, that the fact that many or most choices fall into this gray area where there are pros and cons and it's not clear what the net effect is, doesn't change the fact that there are some choices that are, the jury is pretty much in and they're pretty much clearly bad. Right. And right. I think it's pretty easy to use the former category as an excuse to ignore the latter category.
Exactly. Now, here's another twist, if you don't mind, that I found interesting. So there is some research. We are empirically oriented people here, rationally speaking. So there is some research that shows some really interesting, what I thought counterintuitive initially, but in fact perhaps perfectly in line with human psychology, consequences of engaging in ethical decision making in terms of consumerism. So, for instance, there's a paper that appeared in 2009, which is entitled "Do Green Products Make Us Better People?"
Oh, I saw this. Yeah, and go on.
The answer is not necessarily. So I'm quoting from the paper. Well, in line with the halo associated with green consumerism, people act more altruistically after mere exposure to green than conventional products. However, people act less altruistically and are more likely to cheat and steal after purchasing green products as opposed to conventional products.
Because they're like, I already paid my dues.
Exactly. So I can cut myself some slack,
Right.
I thought that was very, very interesting, because it shows you how complicated this thing is, even at the level of your own behavior. So you need to be careful about the consequences of your own ethical conscience on your next step. What are you going to do next? Therefore,
I wonder how much this effect depends on people's beliefs about, say, how much willpower they have. Because there, in one of our earlier episodes, I don't remember which one, we were discussing these studies on willpower and cognitive exhaustion and how people who were forced to resist temptations for a long period of time, like the temptation to take a break from working, were then less able to resist temptations like sugary foods afterwards, yes, suggesting right. that there is some kind of roughly right. fixed, at least for a short period of time, a fixed amount of willpower you have that gets used up by different things.
That's right.
But then follow-up studies found that that effect is dependent on people's beliefs about whether they have a fixed amount of willpower. So people who don't believe that they have a fixed amount of willpower don't experience that same depletion of their ability to resist future temptations yeah. after resisting prior temptations.
Which is similar, not that we want to get into a discussion of free will again, but it's similar to studies that show that people who don't believe that they have free will, they actually behave more badly as a consequence. So like,
So I wonder if that's a cause or just an excuse after the fact.
Well, but the thing is,
totally clear to me.
Yeah, of course, if you don't believe in free will, nothing is an excuse. It's just the way it is, right? But the fact that knowledge or even alleged knowledge of a certain, in this case, of a metaphysical position, because for all effective purposes, that's what we're talking about, actually does measurably affect human behavior, in this particular case, for the worst. So it's like, okay, well, maybe even if I believe that there is no free will, I shouldn't tell people that there is no free will.
Right.
Because that makes them, ironically, sort of alter their choices, their actions for the worst. There's another concept that I came across doing sort of background readings for this episode, which I found interesting, and I'm actually significantly more suspicious of even than the stuff that we discussed so far. And that's the idea of tax choice.
Tax choice.
Yeah. So tax choice is the same idea of, you know, when we were saying earlier, oh, you vote with your dollars. Yes, but you also pay taxes to a government, presumably, at least most of us do. And the idea has been put forth in several countries that perhaps taxpayers should be able to check boxes about governmental agencies to which they want or do not want to send money. And, you know, so their taxes being directed. Now,
this doesn't fall into the free rider or tragedy of the commons problem where people want to benefit from things but not pay for them, because people still have to pay the same total amount. They can just decide where they want it to go.
Exactly. Okay. Right. So the problem is not quite as obvious as a free rider problem, but there is an issue nonetheless. So I know actually in Italy, where I grew up, that there is a small version of this thing. It's not that the taxpayers can decide the totality of what they pay where it goes, but there is a small percentage. I think it's really small fraction. It's measured in 1/1000 of your total. But there is a small fraction. You can check in a box, and you have a certain number of choices. Where do you want to send? You want the government to send that money. And one of the reasons this thing is controversial is because one of the boxes is the Catholic Church.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
Well, because even though the Catholic Church is no longer the official Church of Italy, there is no longer an official Church of Italy, for whatever reason, Italian politicians at some point thought that was a good idea. You know, well, how can it be bad to send money, taxpayers' money to the church?
Gee, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Let me think about, let me tell you the ways. Now, the issue, so that's controversial because, of course, what you have there is, a substantial portion of the population who perhaps, either because they are believers, they're Catholic themselves, although not all Catholics are necessarily in favor opposed to separation of church and state. But either because you are Catholic or because simply you say, that's a good organization. It's like giving to the Red Cross or whatever it is. So why not send the money? So that's controversial. Now, as I said, it's a very, very small portion, actually, of your total taxes. The rest gets decided, by the government itself. But it's an interesting experiment in that area, and it's been going on for a number of years. Now, I've heard people even on the left side of the political spectrum arguing that the tax choice is a good idea. And what they're thinking of is things like, well, that way I can avoid to send my taxes, let's say, to the military, for instance, right?
Sure.
Yes, but I can also see an equal or larger number of people not only sending their taxes to the military, but in fact withdrawing taxes from, let's say, public education. So this is a really dangerous territory where you now are mixing directly, essentially, the two types of voting that we've been talking about, the actual voting, you know, you, after all, we're still in a democracy and we still can vote and to elect certain politicians, and those politicians will, in fact, send or not send money in the way of, you know, the military, public education, and so on and so forth. So there is, we still have a representative democracy. But now with the idea of tax choice, you can also have essentially a form of direct democracy measured in directly in dollar signs. And I'm pretty sure, despite the fact that this episode is about complications, I'm pretty sure that this is one that I can definitely vote no. I really don't like the idea. It just opens up too many possibilities for abuse or for bad direction of funding with decisions being made at a level where people simply don't have enough background or enough information or enough, you know, reflective you know, time to reflect and think about what they're doing. And I can see very, very easily very bad consequences from this thing.
I see. So this is an example of a policy level decision that you think people are failing to appreciate the additional consequences of.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, when, I mean, especially if we open up the category to policy level decisions, I remember back when I thought I was going to do research in economic development, being especially demoralized at how many instances of foreign aid or attempted interventions in poor countries to help increase public education or salaries or productivity or whatever ended up not only not helping, but just backfiring. Yeah. Like a lot of charities who spend some period of time in a country giving medical care for free or repairing shoes for free or doing some other good service, actually, it turns out, end up displacing the local market for those things. Right. Like, because people know, oh, every year in the summer, the, you know, charity cobblers come and they repair our shoes. So I'll just hold out. I'm not going to pay someone, you know, a cobbler locally to repair my shoes if I can just wait and get it done for free.
Sure.
So then, you know, a potential business is displaced, and then if the charity ever stops, then you know there's no one with the training to repair shoes.
Yep.
So yes, it's, and then you know everything like that. There's 15 more things that just failed to help, and it's not clear why.
Yeah, it's a good example of how easily people can actually twist good deeds into bad ones,
even intentionally. Right?
No, not like even intentionally. That's right.
Sort of acting with good intentions, mm-hmm. or acting rationally, and not trying to cause harm, and yet the result people being worse off than they would have been before.
Now, again, all of this is not, you know, I don't mean, when I brought up the possibility of doing a show on this thing, I didn't mean this necessarily, in fact, I did not mean at all that this should be a cancel for despair, and therefore we should just throw our hands up.
Good. But would you please cheer everyone up before I have to cut to the picks?
So, no, but the point is that, you know, it's, there is information out there, and information is not necessarily straightforward, and frankly, that's just life, right? I mean, you know, a lot of the decisions you make in life have unintended consequences, even in everyday life. Outside of the sort of lofty things that we've been talking about for the last 40 minutes, just everyday decisions, there's always unintended consequences, and you're always making your best guess. And the whole point here is that, well, if the best thing you can do is making a best guess, that there's no guarantee that things are going to go one way or the other, then it seems like if you want to do the ethical thing, you should be paying attention to two things. Number one, get the best information you can. And as I said, there is plenty of, you know, resources out there. There is non-governmental organizations, there are international organizations, there's apps, there's websites, and so on and so forth. But also be conscious of the fact that you may need to change your behavior, to adapt your behavior, to be flexible as new information comes in. This is no different from any other area in life. You know, if you pay attention, let's say, to health advice that comes out and, you know, that gets published in newspapers, well, it turns out, you know, some time ago, I don't know, drinking a certain amount of wine every day was a good thing. And then after that, it becomes a bad thing. And then it turns out, well, actually, it's a good and a bad thing. It depends. It does have certain effects, positive effects, and some negative effects. It really, you need to reach a balance.
This is exactly the sort of thing that people cite when they're arguing that you shouldn't adapt your behavior too much based on this or that study on nutrition, that it, you know, chances are it will be reversed or at least severely called into question within the next few years. So,
yeah,
you know, but why make the sacrifices unless it's like clearly probably not going to be reversed?
Well, and there, that's an interesting point as well. And in fact, in certain areas, yes, you probably want to wait before rushing to buy, you know, the latest pill or to avoid or get rid of completely of whatever habit. But if there is, but if you pay attention, as it turns out, studies in certain areas, for instance, I'm thinking the effect of caffeine, for instance, which is now pretty well established. The effects of caffeine are actually pretty now stable in terms of, you know, the pertinent literature. And they're mostly positive, by the way. So now that they've settled, now you can make informed decisions. But even when things are not settled, it still comes down to a calculation of, you know, how much risk am I willing to take? How much am I willing to modify my behavior? And is it worth it? All of that simply means that you need to be a more reflective person, a better informed and more reflective person, which is, I think, if anything, the general message of these podcasts. There is, you know, you want to be reflective, you want to be thinking about it. And sometimes you're right. Being reflective and thinking about stuff means simply that, you know what, not enough information is forthcoming, or the information is forthcoming is contradictory. Therefore, I'm going to suspend judgment. That sometimes agnosticism on a particular issue is, in fact, the most rational position.
Well, less of a rousing pep talk than I had hoped for, but maybe we can cheer up our listeners with our picks.
Sure.
All right, let's wrap up this section of the podcast and move on to the picks. I'd like to take this moment to remind our listeners that if you're a fan of the Rationally Speaking podcast, you'll definitely enjoy this year's Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, which will be held in New York, New York, the weekend of April 5th through 7th, 2013. Go to nexus.org now to get your tickets. They're on sale. In addition to Massimo and I, you'll also find a lineup of great speakers, including the SGU, Simon Singh, Michael Shermer, and our keynote speaker, physicist Leonard Mlodinow, author of The Drunkard's Walk. Nexus.org, that's NECSS.org. Go get your tickets now.
Welcome back. Every episode, Julie and I pick a couple of our favorite books, movies, websites, or whatever tickles our rational fancy. Let's start, as usual, with Julia's pick.
Thanks, Massimo. My pick is a game. It's a trivia-type game called Wits and Wagers, which I used to good effect in my evaluating advice class at the last CIFAR workshop, and which I've used with friends also to good effect. I find it really useful for practicing essentially the technique of updating well on other people's advice. So the way it works is each card has a set of questions on it. They're all numerical, so they might be how tall is Mount Everest, or they might be how many times did so-and-so win the track medal in the Olympics, etc. And so you make a guess, and your partner makes a guess too, and then you can see each other's guesses, and if you want, you can choose to update your own guess. You know, if the other person disagreed with you, you might decide, well, maybe, you know, maybe it is a little taller than I thought, since this person thinks it's much taller. And then you find out the answer. And what tends to happen is that most people start out overconfident in their own opinions or their own estimates starting out. So they don't update nearly enough towards what their partner thinks. And over time, you can actually, if you're trying, find yourself getting better at recognizing what level of confidence in your own estimate actually translates into, you know, probability of being right. And so nice. You can get better at adjusting your impression.
You can get yourself trained in sort of Bayesian updating.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice. Well, my pick is a book that I'm reading now. I haven't finished it yet, and I'm reviewing it actually for Philosophy Now magazine. And as you know, I'm fond of these series of books, a number of series of books, actually. It's more than one series that has come out in the last several years that popularizes philosophy using sort of pop culture as a vehicle for it, and I contributed to several of those as well. Not to this one, however. This one is called Philosophy and the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. and just came out. And of course,
he stole my heart.
I knew that. And of course, it's got this sort of precious, you know, of course, the reference is to Douglas Adams, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, more than trilogy. I think it's pentalogy, right?
Increasingly poorly named trilogy.
That's right, increasingly poorly named trilogy. There are some really fascinating chapters, like the very first one, for instance, is on ethics, and it's Eat Me, Vegetarianism and Consenting Animals. And it, of course, this is a reference to the scene in the restaurants at the end of the universe where
the animal who wants to be eaten.
That's right, where our heroes are faced with a cow that's genetically engineered to offer herself as a meal. There are several parts in the book. One is on ethics, as I said. There's one, of course, about the meaning of life. There is a third part on metaphysics and artificial intelligence, which is, of course, has a wonderful chapter about Marvin, the paranoid android. And then there's one about logic, method, and satire, which starts out with a chapter entitled God Promptly Vanishes in a Puff of Logic, which is a reference to the first book of the Hitchhiker's. So it's really fun. If people have read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, this is definitely, and you're interested in philosophy, this is definitely the book for you. If you haven't read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the question is, what the hell is wrong with you?
Seriously.
And by the way, one of the things that I'm doing now is I scheduled on my Netflix queue the movie. I want to watch the movie again. I actually watched originally also the BBC TV series. Not when it came out.
I loved that.
Yeah, not when it came out.
I liked it much more than the modern movie.
Yes, definitely. But still, despite the goofy special effects and all that.
I thought the goofy special effects added to it. Anyway.
Okay.
This book sounds great, and I'm both delighted and saddened to hear of its existence. Delighted for obvious reasons, and saddened because I have written several essays about the philosophy of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and I had sort of this vague hope of getting it in this exact volume of the philosophy series if it were someday published, but I've clearly missed my chance.
Yeah, see, that's what happens when you have a good idea. You have to act on it because somebody else is going to come up with it.
Well, it's been another great episode of Rationally Speaking. I enjoyed my conversation with you very much, Massimo. It just occurred to me that we thank our guests, but we don't thank each other. So
no,
I wanted
that's
to tell
right.
you.
Thank you.
What a pleasure it was talking with you on Rationally
All right,
Speaking.
Enough of the self-congratulations. Let's wrap it up.
All right. This concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.